Hey, if you're listening to this, I will assume you're at least interested in money, understanding the economy, and finances as well. And some of us now want to get the next generation interested as well. So check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. Tune into Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Get 1 month free and an extra $10 when you sign up for a Greenlight account at greenlight.com/million.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from KeyBank. Focused knowledge, customized solutions, and the resources of an entire bank. Because the best solutions fit around a business's needs. More at key.com/corporate. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
I guess all it takes to calm the world's stock markets is an extra $500 billion of spending money, huh? Central bankers have pumped about that much into their respective economies since last Thursday. That was when the French bank BNP Paribas set off alarm bells over some of its big investment funds. Today in New York, Goldman Sachs had news of one of its funds, the kind of news that takes $3 billion to fix. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Angie's List, providing thousands of reports on local service companies. Details at 888-944-LIST and angieslist.com. And by Bank of America, believing that healthy communities and a healthy planet are essential to creating opportunities for everyone. Bank of America, Bank of Opportunity.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you here on this Monday. It's the 13th of August today. I'm going to stretch a metaphor here, but I'll say that if the financial markets were a horse race, you could make a case that investors wrapped up the trifecta today. A couple of weeks ago, we had Bear Stearns and two of its funds going broke. Then last week, BNP Paribas, as I mentioned. Today, no less a blue chip than Goldman Sachs hit the headlines. Goldman announced this morning it's pouring $2 billion into one of its own hedge funds, a fund that's lost more than 30% of its value so far this year, most of it in just the past week. Investors like Hank Greenberg, formerly the CEO of AIG, and Los Angeles billionaire Eli Broad pitched in another billion. It might walk like a bailout and talk like a bailout, but Marketplace's Amy Scott says, whatever you do, don't call it a bailout.
Goldman Sachs is calling this an investment opportunity. After the twists and turns in last week's market, one executive said stock prices are out of whack with their real value. In other words, time to go shopping for bargains. But analyst Richard Beauvais with Punk Siegel says Goldman needs the money to keep the fund afloat. At the end of last week, he says the firm's Global Equity Opportunities, or GEO fund, was leveraged 6-1. That means of the $21 billion in the fund, all but $3.6 billion of it was borrowed money.
And that's the danger point, because if the fund were to decline by as much as 5%, you would have wiped out the equity.
Goldman said it's also reducing the leverage in two of its other hedge funds. Beauvais says they and other funds lost money on so-called quantitative strategies that use computer models to predict market moves.
If the market moves differently than what the models predict, the models don't function and money is lost.
Goldman's GEO fund lost more than $1.5 billion. But analyst Eileen Fahey with Fitch Ratings says Goldman can take it. She says investment banks will make plenty of money as trading volume soars, but they also hold a lot of the debt that's being repriced in the credit market.
They've made a lot of money the past 6 quarters, and we do not expect them to be making a lot of money in this quarter, but we do expect some balance between earnings on volume and trading versus, you know, asset repricing.
Hedge fund investors have seen this kind of cash infusion before. Bear Stearns tried to bail out one of its ailing hedge funds with $1.6 billion in emergency funding. Shortly after, the fund filed for bankruptcy. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
We'll grant you that all this stuff is mind-numbingly complicated, from however the heck a quant fund works to why some funds have had to stop allowing withdrawals because they can't do something called mark-to-market. At the bottom of the whole mess is something that sounds fairly self-explanatory, but somehow isn't. The mortgage-backed security. We asked Mike Hatley to come in to give us a tutorial. He's the president of Westgate Horizons Advisors. That's a firm that buys some of those securities. Mike, good to see you.
Thank you, Kai. Nice to be here.
Maybe the best place to start is My Mortgage. Who owns My Mortgage?
That's a good question. And
And that's why we started. And
nobody knows for sure, really, who holds your mortgage. Because in the old days when your parents and my parents were buying their first homes, they went to their local savings and loan or their local bank. They arranged the mortgage. And that bank or savings and loan held the mortgage. And that's who owned the loan.
Today, though, that loan is within hours, I understand, it's sold to somebody else.
That is correct.
Who is it sold to?
Well, investors. There was a great innovation a number of years ago, the invention of these mortgage-backed securities. And mm-hmm. so what that means is you take a pool of a number of loans, and they put them into a new vehicle, a trust, and that trust issues securities.
Securities, that is, something that can be bought or sold on the open market.
Exactly.
Obviously, different investors have different tolerances for risk. So as I understand it, what these guys do is they take those securities and they slice them up by risk profile.
That's right. And in the securities market in general, one of the factors that's important is the ratings for the securities. And the highest possible rating is a AAA. And that means that the risk of loss is very minimal, in theory, at least. And then when you get down to BBB, there's more risk. And down to CCC and below, there's a lot of risk.
How am I going to make money if I buy somebody else's mortgage, whether I buy a slice of the security or a slice of the institution that offers those securities?
Historically, the interest rate that they pay is a little bit higher than an interest rate for the same credit rating from a corporate borrower. So if you were going to buy an investment in a AAA-rated bond from General Electric, that might pay a certain interest rate, but the AAA-rated mortgage-backed security would pay a little bit higher interest rate for the same AAA rating.
Just because there's that touch of risk that is now sort of coming home to roost, right?
That's right.
How does it get to where we are today? Is the hiccup that starts these dominoes falling, is it somebody not making a payment on a mortgage?
That is the hiccup. In the subprime case, which is the biggest problem today, a number of those loans were made to borrowers that probably shouldn't have gotten money in the first place, and the default rates on those loans have spiked dramatically, particularly over the loans originated in 2006 and 2007. When those start defaulting, the securities that are issued based on those mortgages, those have issues as well, and the values of those securities go down when the defaults are rising.
Is this circle irretrievably broken now, or is there a way to sort of fix it so that the system can start working again?
Well, that may be a better question for Ben Bernanke than for me.
Well, I mean, something like an interest rate cut or something like that. I mean, what would it take to fix this whole mess?
I think an interest rate cut might be helpful in that it would make the payments more affordable. But I think the main thing is it's just going to take time for these defaults to cycle through, for the recoveries to cycle through. And it could take several years before the mortgage-backed securities markets return to where they were a year ago.
Mike Hatley is the president of Westgate Horizons Advisors here in Los Angeles. Mike, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Kai.
What we just had with Mike was the big institutional view, how the economics of mortgage-backed securities trickles down through the corporate debt market. But chances are some of us have skin in the subprime game, too, even if we don't know it. Ashley Milne-Tite has been looking into how individual investors might get hit.
If you're concerned about your 401k suffering in this mess, Adam Bold of the mutual fund store says you're probably worrying for nothing. He says a few mutual funds may hold mortgage-backed securities.
But they're really the exception rather than the rule. And it's certainly not anything that the average investor needs to concern themselves with.
Eric Talley of the Berkeley Center for Law, Business, and the Economy is less sanguine. He says the subprime wobbles could still affect investors indirectly. He says hedge funds or pension funds that own a large amount of these types of securities will want to rebalance their portfolios. To do that, they need more cash, and that means selling off some of their other stock.
So what you would end up having is sort of a contagion effect where a crash in one market causes a bunch of large institutional investors to have to start selling in other markets. And when that happens, the price can go down across the board.
That's when the average investor might lose money. Gary Schatzky is a financial advisor. He says people who've bought shares in financial services companies could take a hit too. Many of those companies are invested in the mortgage market. He says this correction is a welcome reality check.
If you're going to try to find a silver lining on this, it would be a wake-up call to people to say, wait a minute, when I'm putting my money in equities or in financial instruments, we better take stock of what the risk is.
Schatzky says investors are getting a nasty reminder that markets can move down as well as up. In New York, I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
After the past couple of weeks, it was almost boring to watch the stock market. Today, we'll have the details when we do the numbers. There are a couple of phrases that keep showing up as journalists try to figure out how best to describe what's happening in the financial markets. Credit squeeze is one. There's liquidity crunch. Another we've seen a lot of since late last week is something called moral hazard, the idea that people who are too well protected if they should do something stupid might go ahead and do something stupid. It's an insurance term that's been hijacked by economists. And another way to think of it, given the news, is this. Should the Federal Reserve be pumping money into the system to help out the likes of Goldman Sachs, institutional players that took big risks when times were good and money was cheap? Commentator Krishna Guha maintains that's looking at it the wrong way.
Now, the Fed has to be very careful not to promote moral hazard. If it were to bail out investors who took a punt on subprime mortgages or bought into fancy derivatives they did not understand, it would only encourage reckless risk-taking in the future. But nothing the Fed has done so far amounts to bailing out reckless investors. What it has done is to provide liquidity to credit-worthy institutions. It's lending against good quality securities, such as loans guaranteed by Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac. This is central banking 101. The Fed always acts as a lender of last resort when private markets are too spooked to lend at normal rates, even to borrowers holding sound assets. The Fed is not trying to stop the repricing of risky assets by helping to ensure that the markets have enough liquidity to work. Quite the opposite. It is allowing the repricing process to continue while trying to prevent any unnecessary fallout. What would promote moral hazard would be any move to cut interest rates that was not obviously justified by collateral damage from the market turmoil to the real economy. There are plenty of people who would like the Fed to do that, but I doubt that Mr. Bernanke and his colleagues would be willing to oblige. And that is why it is way too soon to conclude that the Fed will be cutting interest rates in September or even sooner. If dislocations in the market last long enough and run deep enough to threaten the supply of credit to home buyers or to businesses, then the Fed might cut interest rates. But what the Fed will not do is cut rates simply in order to help out badly burned hedge fund managers and hapless foreign investors left holding the subprime bag. That would indeed be a case of risking moral hazard.
Krishna Guha covers the Federal Reserve for the Financial Times. Send us your comments online as best. Our homepage is marketplace.org. Business travelers know the drill by now. Do everything you can to avoid checking your bags. But even if you do that, the hassles don't end. Taking your computer out of its case or separating your liquids into those little plastic baggies, it's enough to make you wish your clothes would just magically appear wherever you're going. Alex Goldmark reports.
Alex Arvanitidis travels for business a lot.
At least this year, I'm on pace to do about 100 round trips, 200 legs. Over the next 12 months.
And when you travel that often, spending 2 or 3 hours each trip to pack or waiting at the airport baggage claim, well, it adds up. So Arvanitidis found an alternative.
I could log into my virtual closet, drag and drop the clothes I'll need depending on who I'll be meeting and what I'll be doing. I enter the destination, the hotel that I'll be staying at, tell them the arrival and departure date, and the clothes meet me at the hotel.
It's part of a new service called Flylight. Arvanitidis keeps 2 weeks' worth of clothes and toiletries in a remote storage space managed by Flylight. He can see photos on the internet, and instead of packing or doing laundry, he just clicks. Flylight founder Steve Zielinek.
And what we've done is we've set up modular California-style closets. Each one is dedicated to an individual. It's lined with cedar, and, you know, we've taken great care because generally our clients are they're high ends.
The climate-controlled closets are in different cities around the country. So I live in New York. If I travel to Washington, D.C. twice a month, my clothes can just stay in D.C., waiting for me. That costs about $100 a trip.
But if you've got to get your clothes from, say, D.C. closet to an L.A. hotel, then typically that would be somewhere between $150 and $200.
The cost depends on the distance the clothes have to travel, and dry cleaning is extra. For people who don't mind doing their own packing, several companies will forward their luggage. It's like FedExing your bags door to door. Zeke Adkins is co-founder of Luggage Forward, with a slightly different customer base.
Typical customer skews a little bit older in age. Folks that maybe are retired have ample time to travel. I would categorize them as typically the luxury leisure traveler, taking on average a longer trip, requiring them to take more things, to have more things at their destination.
Any way you beat the baggage check line saves time, and that's often worth more than money, especially to our friend Alex Arvanitidis, the busy business traveler.
Time is of the essence. I could always make more money. I can't put more than 24 hours in a day.
Traveling light in New York, I'm Alex Goldmark for Marketplace.
Coming up, the war spills over Iraq's borders.
We can very confidently say that it's the biggest refugee crisis since the Palestinians came through in 1948.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Federal Reserve and central banks around the world wrestled the rowdy stock market to a virtual draw today. The Dow Industrials finished nearly flat at 13,236, shaved off just 3 points, a tiny fraction of 1%. The Nasdaq nudged down 2 points, a tenth of 1%. Close at 2542. The S&P 500 was also flat, down less than a single point and just a hair of a percent to end at 1452. The Dow was actually in positive territory until shortly before the bell, but worries about the subprime mortgage fallout are clearly still nagging. Fannie Mae was among the stocks tugging at the financial sector. Its shares lost 3.5% after federal regulators turned down its plans to buy more mortgages. Bond prices rose. That pushed the yield on the 10-year Treasury note down to 4.76%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing money since 1937 with a focus on consistent results over the long term. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Ever hear a song on Marketplace but you just can't place it? Or maybe it's the first time you've heard it and you want to hear it again. Just click on the archive section of our website. We list the songs we play on every show in that day's rundown. There's even a link to an online store where you can buy the song and help fund public radio programming. It's all at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. The Labor Department reports on the Producer Price Index for July. On August 14, 1935, President Roosevelt signed the Social Security Act into law, and a Viking replica ship is due to arrive in Dublin after a long journey from Denmark. The Sea Stallion measures 30 meters in length and has 60 oars aboard. It carries 65 crew members on holiday. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Most of us are feeling some kind of financial pinch at the moment. High energy prices or rising school fees. Health insurance costs going up twice as fast as inflation is. But don't count on the boss to help you out much. We learned today plans for your pay increase are decidedly modest. From WGBH in Boston, Marketplace's Helen Palmer reports.
And the magic number that companies are budgeting for pay raises next year?
Across the board, it's 3.9%.
That's Ryan Johnson of World at Work, a human resource association that's tracked this figure for 34 years. Johnson says it's not all bad news. Managers will definitely give some workers more.
You're paying for performance, and you're giving the best performers a 6 or 7 or 8% raise, And fortunately, some people are still going to get a 0 or 1% raise, the low performers.
Johnson says that kind of variable pay or pay for performance is the norm now for 80% of companies. Gary Chasen, who teaches labor issues at Clark University, calls this survey extremely demoralizing for workers because it shows who gets the lion's share of the pay raises.
An increasingly large share of budgetary allocations of companies are going for the company's executives and their senior officers rather than for most workers.
Labor's lost bargaining power, Chasen says. If you factor in inflation, the U.S. hourly wage has actually fallen over the last 5 years, even as productivity has shot up. But Tom Cochen, professor of management at MIT's Sloan School, says companies are in a tight corner here too.
Companies are struggling because of increased international competition. The cost of healthcare and other benefit increases are putting pressure on their salary budgets.
That makes it hard for them to raise wages. But Cochen says he doubts that U.S. workers will accept another decade of stagnant pay in the face of skyrocketing executive compensation, though it's not obvious what workers can do. In Boston, I'm Helen Palmer for Marketplace.
It's high summer, the beach is beckoning, and we've asked some of our commentators to give us their nominations for the best business beach book ever. I know it sounds oxymoronic, but we're looking for titles that won't make you sleepy, just smarter, all while you dig your toes into the sand. Nell Minow kicks off our series. In her day job at the corporate library, Nell deals with business ethics, but her pick is a classic tale about a thief.
Well, actually, Robin Hood is a classic tale about a great CEO. Sir Robin of Locksley was a nobleman who rebelled when evil Prince John tried to take control in what today we might call a hostile takeover. The other nobles went along, but Robin protected the peasants and led a band of outlaws in robbing from the rich to pay King Richard's ransom and restore him to the throne. Robin Hood exemplified all of the qualities of a great leader. He had a clear vision that he communicated effectively. He understood his goal and never got distracted. He did not ask others to take risks that he was not willing to take. Best of all, when Little John tossed Robin off the log into the water, Robin immediately offered him a job, saying, "I love a man who can best me." Every great CEO I've met understood that the secret to success is surrounding yourself with people who are better than you are, not feeling threatened by them. But why rob? Yes, it is satisfying to steal from the rich, but it is a high-risk, short-term strategy that isn't sustainable. Eventually, the rich are going to figure out that they'd better not carry their jewels and gold when they go through the forest. Once Robin met his goal and returned Richard, he needed an entirely new business plan. But his weakness wasn't a lack of vision. He just happened to be born a few centuries before the invention of the corporate structure. If he'd had the opportunity to raise capital through a public offering, he'd have founded Sherwood Industries and put those peasants to work turning trees into consumer goods. And the great-great-great-great-grandchildren of those peasants would now be the shareholders of a successful manufacturing company.
Nell Minow is the editor of The Corporate Library. If you've got a favorite beach book with a business touch to it, let us know. We're posting listeners' recommendations on our website. It's marketplace.org. The United Nations Security Council voted on Friday to expand its operations in Iraq. A good part of the mission will focus on the growing number of Iraqi refugees. Neighboring countries like Jordan have tightened their visa and passport requirements. So the only country in the world right now that willingly admits Iraqi refugees is Syria. So far, roughly 1.5 million Iraqis have fled there. But some Syrians now want the welcome mat to be rolled up. Jennifer Glass reports from Damascus.
Tensions are running high outside the Damascus office of the UN Refugee Agency, the UNHCR. People wait in the sweltering sun to get paperwork they need for aid or to be eligible for resettlement. They say no one is doing enough for them.
All these organizations should do a lot more for people who left their job, their life in Iraq, everything they have.
These people are only a fraction of the refugees here. Less than 10% of Iraqis are registered with the UNHCR. The agency doesn't have the capacity to process everyone, and some Iraqis are too scared or mistrustful of the UN. Working quietly and coolly inside the UNHCR building is Lawrence Yolis. The agency director knows what's happening outside, and he's concerned. The problems in Syria are growing as the refugees keep coming.
We can very confidently say that it's the biggest refugee crisis since the Palestinians came through in 1948. We're talking about overcrowded schools, we're talking about more difficulties in accessing the health system, about difficulties in finding apartments, about rents that have increased.
It's hard to say exactly what this costs Syria, but the Syrian government says the Iraqis are costing them $1 billion a year.
There are huge expenses. They haven't all yet been documented in the way that perhaps would be easy to see.
Syrian political analyst Samir Al-Taki says it is easy to see that 10% more people means
10% increase in the burden of the health system, the education system, and even regarding foods. We have some essential foods that are subsidized by the government. Some services are beginning to crack.
Education and health care are free. But Salah Salem and his wife Mona haven't been able to find a place in school for their 5-year-old daughter Dahlia. She's the reason they came. They fled Iraq after she was kidnapped. Mona cries often.
I'm crying because I don't want this life for us and for my kids. They're still very young and they're suffering even to go to school. The simplest things are very hard here. That's why we're saying that there's no stability here. And we want to leave because everything is very, very hard.
Like many Iraqis, they are living off their savings and don't know what will happen when the money runs out. Salem can't legally work, and black market jobs don't pay much. Like the first waves of most refugees, the first to hit Syria's borders were the wealthiest and best connected. They had money and bought properties and businesses. In this northeastern town of Qamishli, Syrians initially prospered, selling satellite dishes and food across the border. But now, poor, desperate Iraqis are coming here, at the Hotel Qamishli. Syrian goodwill is running out. Ahmed Hussein's father owns the place.
3 years ago, people were happy when the Iraqis came because they were like, yeah, more money, more work. And now it's like, they want fewer of them to go now.
Last year, the United States took in 200 Iraqi refugees. This year, it says it will accept 7,000. Syria says it feels stuck with a mess America made. The United States is reluctant to directly help Syria because it believes it's sheltering terrorists and helping to stir problems in Iraq. But there may be a tipping point. Syria could decide the cost of the Iraqis is too high and close its borders. In Damascus, I'm Jennifer Glass for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a diversified approach to fixed income can strengthen your portfolio. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note, Brooke Astor has died. Over the course of her life, the philanthropist and socialite gave away more than $200 million to New York institutions. They include the Metropolitan Museum of Art, the New York Public Library, and Central Park. Astor inherited her fortune when her husband, Vincent Astor, passed away. He was the great-great-grandson of John Jacob Astor, who made the family fortune in the fur trading business and in real estate, too. Brooke Astor was 105 years old. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow lost 3 points, 0.02%. The Nasdaq dropped 2 points, 0.1%. The S&P 500 fell just a fraction of a point, staying basically flat. Our producers include Megan Larson, Caitlin Carroll, Jennifer Collins, and Fiona Ng. Marketplace was created by Jim Russell. Next time, big acts like Barbara Streisand command a pretty penny.
There were people sitting not only in front of her and to the side of her, but behind her, who've paid at least £100 for the privilege of watching the back of her head.
But those days may soon be over. I'm Kai Rizdahl. I hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
all over the country.
We need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.